very much. I hope I put myself in the category of non-imperialist scholars who are working on these things. What I'd like to talk about today, very briefly, is a bit about what we know, and mostly what we don't know, about the psychological and emotional impact of post-conflict justice on victims of war and atrocity. And we can think about transitional justice in many ways, we heard about earlier in the opening plenary. But transitional justice mechanisms are really intended, I think, to promote a wide range of effects depending on what you're interested in, what your perspective is. For the purposes of this paper, I sort of summarized them in two categories. The first are really political and institutional effects, and these are things like development of democracy, rule of law, institutional political development, human rights protection, and the like. The other sort of group of effects are what I would call psychological and emotional effects. And these are effects not just on victims, but also perpetrators as well, and individuals and groups. And these effects include sort of a wide range of factors, providing some sort of sense of justice for victims, healing emotional and psychological trauma, reducing desire for vengeance, encouraging, promoting personal and intergroup reconciliation and the like. And I would also put deterrence in there, though deterrence tends to cut across the institutional as well as the psychological effect, but ultimately deterrence arguments are about psychology, they're about trying to instill fear of punishment, in order to deter perpetrators from carrying out their future crimes, so I stuck it in this category. And I think we're really only now beginning to understand more fully whether truth-telling, post-conflict truth-telling, actually has any of these intended effects. We heard from Lee Payne earlier, her study is one among very few that are assembling large data sets on transitional justice and trying to look at effects. Lee's work is looking at democracy, primarily. Other people, Catherine Seeking, for example, and David Kim, are compiling data sets trying to look at things like deterrence effects, for example. So this work is being done. What my paper really does is focus on a much narrower slice of this second category, right, of the psychological and emotional effects, and namely the effects on psychological and emotional effects on victims in the aftermath of war and atrocity. I should say as well that my broader interest here is in the relationship between formal truth-telling mechanisms, trials, truth commissions, formal accountability mechanisms, if you like, and post-conflict, post-Civil War peace building. So I'm really interested here in this link between truth-telling and transitional justice broadly in preventing the resumption of violence in post-war societies. And the psychological and emotional impact on victims, I think, is a key assumption of truth-telling proponents, as well as some of their critics, as I'll talk about in a minute. And it's an important intermediate step, really, in the causal logic of truth-telling's impact on peace and stability. But I'm also interested in the sort of the issue that sort of spurred this particular paper was how much I often read about victims' demand for justice. Right? And there are lots of studies that have been done that have shown this, that when you ask victims and survivors of war and atrocity if they want justice, they say yes, they do. And I've always thought, okay, they want it. Do they actually get it at some point through the formal transitional justice mechanism? So that was sort of started my thinking on this particular project. So in just the few minutes that I have, I'm going to very quickly walk through what the causal claims are that are made about psychological and emotional effects Then I'll talk about the questions that I ask, the specific questions I ask, and how I go about answering them in the paper. Very quickly run through the findings and the conclusion, and then sum up with a bit of the implications of this for our understanding of post-conflict justice and the role of post-conflict peace-building processes. Now, the logic here. Those who see psychological and emotional benefits of post-conflict justice really posit two main causal mechanisms that tend to follow from formal post-conflict justice mechanisms. The first is really an emotional effect. That is, truth-telling, formal truth-telling in some variety heightens a sense of justice for victims, and this in turn has a whole series of effects, but the ones I'm particularly interested in is effects on desires for vengeance, tolerance for calls for violence or attributed violence, and propensity towards reconciliation. There's also a psychological effect, that is, it is purported to help heal psychological trauma, to provide some therapeutic benefit to victims as well, and this in turn has similar effects on desires for vengeance and the like. I'd also note here that the flip side of this is also true, so that those who see benefits of truth-telling also see harm that's caused due to the absence of it. Okay? So in this sense, when you don't have truth-telling, you get a heightened sense of injustice, psychological trauma continues, and this has a series of negative effects leading to increased risk of violent conflict. So just to go back to this slide then, on the benefits, that's sort of one set of effects for those who see benefits. There also is also a logic for those that see harm that's generated by post-conflict justice. And the logic here is essentially that truth-telling is dangerous, harmful, primarily because it has effects in terms of re-traumatizing victims. And that this, in a sense, is re-traumatization, makes people more tolerant of calls for retributive violence, support for violent spoilers and the like, and leads to problems in terms of reconciliation. So my focus in the paper is really on the first half of these various causal chains. I speculated about the second half, but I don't really dwell on it. I'll say more about it when I talk about implications. But essentially, it's the first half here that I'm primarily interested in. So what are the questions then? Pretty simple questions. The first is, do we actually observe any of these psychological and emotional effects empirically? Right? We've got lots of cases of post-conflict justice. What effect do they actually have on victims? Does it, in fact, satisfy them? Does it make them feel less vengeful? Does it heal their psychological ills, or does it actually cause more harm than good, as some have argued? The second question is, again, quite simple. Let's assume for a moment that the empirical record is clear, or some people argue it's too soon to tell what these effects are. Should we expect to observe them based on what we know about psychology, criminal psychology, the role of victims in criminal justice process? Two simple questions, how I go about answering them. Rather than sort of looking at the entire universe of cases, which is a little difficult to do, I focus on two in the paper, the South African case and the case of the ICTY. Why do I do this? Three reasons. First is, I'm looking under the light. These are obviously seminal cases of post-conflict justice. Lots of research has been done on these cases. There's a fairly large empirical record, so I'm looking where most of the evidence is. The second reason is that they represent different approaches to justice. Obviously, there's lots of variation here, but it's very crudely looking at a sort of retributive approach versus a more restorative approach. There's obviously debates in the field about the merits of one approach over the other. This is a nice way of sort of getting at it by looking at these two cases. And finally, given the tremendous amount of attention and resources that are devoted to these, both of these particular institutions, I would argue that they provide, in some ways, best cases of this. Right? Given the attention that's been devoted to them, if we don't see any particular benefit or harm from truth-telling on victims, then we have to really ask why we would expect to see it in other cases as well. But this is obviously open to some debate. But that's my thinking for why these two cases. What do I look at in terms of the trying to answer the second question? Well, there I'm basically mining evidence from clinical and forensic psychology. So I'm interested in studies on the nature and treatment of psychological trauma, research in forensic psychology on victims' experiences with quote-unquote ordinary criminal justice, usually in Western contexts, as well as more informal or increasingly formalized restorative justice approaches as well. Now, there are important institutional differences between what we would call ordinary justice and post-conflict justice. I don't want to dwell on them. I just argue that we should be able, despite the qualitative difference, the different institutional contexts here, we should be able to make some inferences about the plausibility of causal claims of both proponents and critics of truth-telling by looking at this literature, right? If, for example, we rarely see victim satisfaction with the process or the outcome of very robust Western criminal justice systems, then we would need to ask why we would expect to see this in cases of post-conflict justice where perhaps the systems are not as robust and the crimes that are being discussed are arguably much graver and more traumatic. So in other words, this is, again, looking at kind of ordinary justice is sort of an easy test of this. So what's the evidence? Very quickly, what do we find when we look at the empirical record? First, I'll say just sort of generally that there's a lot of literature on both these cases. There's not as much on the impact on victims, and in fact, there's very, very little research, good quality research, that's done in a sophisticated way. I would point to Hugo's work as an example of work that's done in a pretty sophisticated way to try and get at some of these questions. Most of what we have is anecdotal information. Okay. So let me just very quickly walk through what the evidence says. And I'm just going to tease out some observations. This isn't everything, but I'm just going to tease out a few. First thing we find is that responses are highly individualized and idiosyncratic. Some have seen justice as being served, are satisfied. Many, if not most, are not. Some dissatisfied victims demand violent retribution. They demand, for example, that punishment be death for those that are found guilty. For others who might be unhappy with the process procedurally, don't necessarily have any particular demands for violent retribution. We don't see a lot of consistency then between satisfaction and the type of punishment. Secondly, there doesn't appear to be a real difference in victim satisfaction between trials or truth commissions, or whether or not victims participate directly in those processes or not. And we see no evidence that truth-telling has, on average, healed psychological trauma, nor any evidence that it has caused psychological trauma through some kind of re-traumatization. And truth-telling, in fact, seems to have really no observable impact, either negative or positive, on mental health of victims. Now, given that these are sort of based on, at most, say, a dozen studies from only two cases, these are highly qualified observations, right? But what, if anything, then can we infer from this broader forensic and clinical psychology literature? If we look at the forensic psychology literature, find a few things. First is that some victims report benefits from participating in trials, but most report negative experiences. Secondly, there doesn't seem to be any clear relationship between the severity of punishment and feelings of revenge. And finally, victim satisfaction with restorative justice processes, such as victim-offender mediation, is quite high, but there are very limited conditions under which that's likely to happen that don't really approximate the conditions that we see in, say, a truth commission. Contexts are very different. That's forensic psychology. What about clinical psychology? No real surprises here. But one interesting fact that I'll mention is that we know that sort of through clinical study, that those who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, are much more likely to accept or tolerate violent solutions to conflict, have higher levels of feelings of vengeance. Okay. However, there's no real substantial evidence that brief interventions, which is essentially what, say, testifying a trial might be, or a treatment, there's no real evidence that these brief interventions that follow a traumatic event offer any real lasting benefit. In fact, many studies have found that they can have this opposite effect, which can be quite harmful. Now, again here, the caveat, very large caveat, is that there are very few, surprisingly in some ways, very few good quality studies that actually look at victim responses to criminal justice. We don't really know all that much about this. So the conclusion then before I get on to some of the implications, what I find is that really our knowledge and our understanding of victims' experiences with truth telling is extremely limited. Based on the available evidence, we simply can't conclude with any real confidence that it has any of the psychological or emotional benefits or harms that are often claimed. And the very best studies that we have, empirical studies, raise some doubts about the more optimistic claims of the benefits. And we've certainly heard already what some of those doubts are. So the sort of notion that formal truth-telling processes satisfy victims' need for justice, that it somehow dampens their retributive urges and desire for vengeance, is, I think, at best, a question that's still open. Let me finish up then with some few brief observations about the implications of this for truth-telling's role in promoting post-conflict peace-building more generally. First has to do with the relationship between individual victims and societal conflict. Even though the paper raises some serious doubts about the psychological benefits of truth-telling for victims, even if we did find some measurable benefit, we still have little understanding of the consequences of this for societal reconciliation. We know, for example, as I mentioned, that those who suffer from PTSD are more vengeful, they're less open to nonviolent dispute resolution. But what this tells us about larger societal peace and conflict is, in fact, unclear. So, for example, it assumes that trauma, psychological trauma, mental illness, the desire for revenge, it assumes that this is sort of widespread in societies, in post-conflict societies. Right? So the logic is we have to worry about the victims because there are so many of them, and they're liable to create all kinds of problems. In fact, studies have found that while there is, in fact, a large degree of suffering and measurable sort of clinical, psychological suffering that follows massive violence, there are still large segments of society that don't suffer from this. So it's an important assumption that's embedded there that we need to think about. It also assumes that merely a desire for revenge somehow translates into actual acts of violence. You know, we're talking about propensities here, so obviously those who are more open to violent solutions are might be more willing to engage in them. But the fact is, we don't really know, and we have no evidence at all, how often victims engage in violent retribution. We just don't know. This leads to a second observation. That there's really a clear tension between the efforts that are needed to promote, say, the emotional, psychological well-being of individual victims and what's needed for societies as a whole. That there's this tension between what's useful and beneficial for victims and what societies as a whole might need in terms of promoting peace in the aftermath of war. So just to give you one example, society as a whole has a potential interest in trying to dampen desires for vengeance among victims. Why? Because there's an assumption that if they have this desire, then it's going to translate into actual acts of violence, and this can be destabilizing and undermine peace processes. On the other hand, individual victims, what this does is, in a sense, pathologizes what some people say is a very healthy, normal response to trauma, right, which is desire for revenge. Right? And in fact, trying to dampen that, trying to get victims to not be vengeful, to not desire revenge or retribution, that doing that might actually be harmful to the individual. Right? So there's this tension, clear tension here between these two. And then finally, there's, important implications for arguments about institutional reform. There are many skeptics of truth-telling's benefits, psychological and emotional benefits, who often propose a range of reforms to truth-telling institutions in order to make them more victim-friendly. Right? But I think we should be somewhat cautious about this. Right? It assumes that the problem is fundamentally institutional. Right? That is, it lies less with faulty implementation of justice rather than a problem that is inherent to the search for justice for victims after atrocity. Right? There is some evidence out there that victims will be dissatisfied really with any process, justice process, as long as it doesn't meet their expectations initially. So there's always a letdown of some kind. And there's this big gap then between kind of initial expectations and the sanction that's then handed down through the process. Right? Even if the process is totally fair, right, victims will be deeply dissatisfied. Right? So it's not clear then if perhaps the opposite holds true. Right? Will victims perceive justice to have been done if their expectations are met? In fact, we need to ask, why we would expect anyone in the face of massive brutality to be satisfied with any form of redress. So we should ask, can victims' expectations ever really be met? Right? If they can, then maybe there's an institutional reform in place that can achieve it. If not, I'm not sure institutional reform is really the answer. I'll leave it at that. Thanks very much, and I welcome your comments and questions.